Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support. Today's episode from The Silo is an above-average intelligence with Mark Polymeropoulos and Jerry O'Shea on why the U.S.'s relationships with our partners have always been our greatest strength. We hope you enjoy.
Nine. 12. 10. 28. 2. 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super-secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
All right, welcome to the podcast. I am Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Spy Show. Today, I am very happy to welcome as my guest, Jerry O'Shea. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's good to be here.
So I'm going to embarrass you a little bit with some kind of bio and background. But first, let me just say that you are one of those officers in our service who is not only known as a tremendous case officer and manager, but you're a great storyteller. You're a great interlocutor. So this is going to be fun. I wish we had more than 40 minutes. But with your career and all the incredible stories, could probably spend several hours here. But let me just give the audience a little bit of background. You're originally from upstate New York. You were, as you have said before, afflicted with a severe case of wanderlust. You left home at 18. You lived and studied in Germany, doing all sorts of odd jobs, waiter, construction, then traveled years roaming Europe, Africa, South Asia, and the Middle East, and then attended university in Austria, Germany, Mexico, and grad school in Arizona. No wonder you had something like a Lawrence of Arabia complex. I love it. And then you recruited into the CIA, working undercover as an operations officer for over 30 years, extraordinary service to our country, serving again in Europe, Africa, South Asia, and the Middle East, numerous war zones. We'll talk about that a little bit, and a four-time chief of station, which is really an extraordinary achievement. And then finally, one of the things that you do now is kind of taking a jump into the entertainment world. And I think that's, you know, for someone like myself, and I think a lot of the audience too, as we watch or read things about espionage, if you had practiced it, if you had been a practitioner, Hollywood doesn't necessarily get it right. So you can fix those things, right all those wrongs, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But again, you know, welcome, Jerry. Great honor to be here today with you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and some of the stories I tell are partly true, so it's fun.
Now, I will say that my co-host, David Rothkopf, is not here today. We're taping this a little off schedule because Jerry is halfway across the world. But I would be remiss in not saying that my Red Sox swept David's New York Yankees three straight. We'll call it the Boston Massacre, too. So if David had been here, I would have talked quite a bit about the Red Sox victory. And as opposed to, I think, last week when we talked a lot about my attendance to various heavy metal shows over the last several weeks in the summer. So my summer's coming to an end of trying to be a college kid again. But let me just kind of jump in right away. It's something that's probably near and dear to your heart is where you're living now. And the terrible tragedy that occurred with the wildfires in Hawaii. I think, you know, first of all, it's, you know, we mourn the loss of life. But the second, you know, just as you know, while the intelligence world is a little bit different than disaster preparedness, I do want to kind of ask you, Jerry, how in the heck did this happen?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out, but it's going to be I think it's going to happen is they're going to find that it was a, you know, an incredibly unfortunate, tragic set of circumstances. Everything from environmental degradation with invasive species coming in, getting rid of the the indigenous species that are more resilient and keep more more moisture in the ground with urban architecture. So in Lahaina, there was only two ways out. And a lot of it's sort of basic human failures. For example, we've got this, technologically, we've got this great alarm system you've probably heard about, but it's set for tsunamis. And so the people in charge of it, when the wildfire was happening, they were afraid of if they set off the alarm, the standing instructions were to seek higher ground, which would actually push people into the fire. So at that moment, they were wondering, do we use the alarm and cause a greater loss of life, or don't we? There wasn't an alarm for a fire, and for a fire that was moving at, you know, upwards of 50 to 60 miles an hour. And I happened to be in Molokai right next to Maui the day before the fire started. And you know, we had this hot, dry wind whipping through, and it only literally takes one spark to set it off. And of course, the town is all built of wood. And it's older, 80, 90 years old, and the sort of the downtown parts, and it's dry wood. So it was tinder dry and sort of being ready to happen. And failure, I think, was one to prepare, and was one even to imagine what the consequences could be.
And I guess there's a question too, because you know, you and I have talked about this privately on multiple issues about kind of accountability in the national security world, maybe accountability in the intelligence arena with our old outfit at CIA. But do you think there's going to be? And so, I think one of the things that I've always, you know, stressed is that sometimes we are not held accountable as one should be. What about in Hawaii? Are they going to start holding officials accountable?
Oh, it'll be. You know, it's funny you say that, because it's really echoes right now of what happened after 9/11, and I think the failure was really one of imagination. Same as 9/11. No one realized this could happen. And of course, it won't happen again because we'll be ready for it. But what will happen next time will be something we're not ready for. Right. So yeah, I think there's accountability, but you know, accountability too often comes down to let's find a victim and point at them. Right. And then you get into this Tweed ring thing. So I'd like to get away from, you know, who is responsible, and then come to a greater understanding of what mosaic of circumstances came together to make this possible. And I think climate change is going to be, you know, driving a lot of these things at the bottom of it. You know,
one of the things that I recall, it was maybe a month ago, and I think I talked about it in some media circles on air. I believe was, you know, Bill Burns made a speech. And he talked about some of the challenges for the intelligence community, and you know, it's the usual kind of great power competition with China, obviously Russia, Ukraine, but he mentioned climate change, and a lot of people sometimes roll their eyes on that. But if you think about, he also said it's climate change and kind of other things like pandemics. But when you think about it now, there are national security challenges that go beyond what we were used to in our career, which have to do with, you know, what's the next, you know, plague that occurs, or what about climate? And I think there's nothing wrong with the intelligence community, you know, putting some focus on that.
I think we have to. I think things like going deeper into issues and not addressing symptoms is really important. So climate change is going to drive things like unrest in the Middle East. You know, it's going to drive, you know, you can't talk about Syria or Lebanon, places like that, if you can't talk about, you know, their inability to feed themselves. You can't talk about huge migrant exoduses going to Europe if you can't talk about what's going on in the Sahel, where, again, they can't feed themselves. These are sort of existential things. So things like radicalism, things like mass migration, things like local conflict and war. I think they're complicated issues, but they're also being driven by existential drivers. And I think climate change is at its core one of those, and we need to understand how that fits into it.
And of course, you know, and there's a political dimension in that too. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes
there shouldn't be, but there is.
Yeah. There shouldn't be, but there is. Let's just switch a bit to your career. You know, in the introduction and the bio, and again, I wanted to embarrass you a little bit. I didn't do a good enough job about it, but with your, you know, you really did have this incredibly diverse career. And so, you know, what do I know about Jerry, you know, that I can say in public? Well, you did everything from, you know, I think I recall that you were witnessed the fall of the wall, but then served in Europe long after and saw kind of, you know, and what we can say, not the rise of Trump, but kind of the Trump foreign policy, which certainly did not put NATO at the kind of the forefront of our interests. And then, of course, you also served in war zones and did some really, you know, heroic stuff for the country, being a part of some of the first teams in to some of our conflict zones. So talk, maybe choose two or three moments of your career just to tell the audience. You know, one of the things I always say is when I talk to young college students, I say, you know, CIA is an extraordinary place where you can both witness history, but also affect history. So with that kind of theme in mind, give a sense of some of those seminal moments in your career.
Yeah. So when we talked about doing this, you know, alliances was one of the things that we wanted to touch on. And I think alliances fit into this really well, and it fits into very well with your career as well. So yeah, as a young officer in Germany in 89, I happened to be in Berlin when I watched the wall come down. And, you know, one of the things that was very clear that came out of that was this reservoir of goodwill toward democracies and toward, you know, a system of rules that the U.S. represents and leads, but isn't the only member of. And so, is at that time, not only the wall come down, but watching the Baltic nations break free, watching Eastern Europe break free of Soviet tyranny. And what did those countries want? What was in their interest and our interest? They wanted strong alliances with a partner they could trust, that wasn't going to suppress them, that would treat them as partners. And partnerships are difficult, as is in any marriage. But what came out of that, I think, the wall fell. Yeah, that's something that happened. But the result of that was an expansion of NATO, and not because NATO wanted to expand, but because those countries sought shelter under the NATO umbrella, that they wanted those alliances. And I think the magic and the genius of American foreign policy since World War II is creating those alliances. So let's go forward to September 11th. People in our generation, that was a touchstone thing. On September 11th, depending where you were, you would have seen, turning on CNN, countries around the world, even, you know, for a while, including Russia, that wanted to support us. And you were in Afghanistan, and as was I, and you know, there was people from the country of Georgia and the Baltics and the Poles and the Mongolians. And the reason they were there, yeah, okay, they felt bad about 9/11, but they also felt a sense of solidarity, and they wanted to contribute toward this alliance. And I think today, looking at Ukraine and sort of where we are now, and what we came through with the last administration, where we were able to, I think, just barely keep our alliances together, I think it is enormously important to us and in our interest to maintain those alliances that we've had. And Mark, that you and I throughout our careers have struggled to keep going. And I say struggled because alliances is something maybe what we should talk about, what they are. It's not a black and white, they're my friend, they're not. Alliances are something that are shifting, that you need to continually work to rebuild, and that are based on common interest, and I would say trust, but trust at the bedrock level, not trust that one politician is going to say something bad about another, or they'll have different trade policies. And I'll finish up by saying, oddly, in Europe, you know, the only major European country we've never gone to war with is the one that we like to make fun of a lot, is the French, right? I mean, we fought the British, we fought the Germans, we fought the Italians, you know, but, you know, it was, you know, apart from the Belgians, who love them, great Fritz, they don't really matter. The French, despite the fact that it's a complicated, difficult relationship, we've had 250 years of an alliance that has served us both very well and made us both stronger.
So I agree with you really on everything you said. I mean, that's really the theme of the show today, the importance of alliances. But you could also make an argument. I think actually, this is almost the phrase that people are throwing about for President Biden's foreign policy, is the importance of building alliances. If you look how we, you know, the kind of the moving the aircraft carrier to the east well, that means a U.S. focus on China. But what does that mean? It means, you know, additional basing in the Philippines. It means, you know, the recent summit at Camp David yesterday with Japan and South Korea. It means announcement of a future Biden visit to Vietnam. I think the White House yesterday said, well, it's really not all about China, except it is. And it's all about building alliances in terms of our kind of our struggle there. So I agree totally with that. One thing that I think you've said in the past is, or, you know, you have to nurture alliances. Right. And I think that's a perfect word. And so maybe let's jump in and talk just a little bit about what that meant in our old job at CIA, because, you know, people always think that a CIA case officer, the job both of us had, we spend most of our time recruiting unilateral, you know, agents, sources. And that means, you know, kind of in a methodical fashion, sometimes it's quicker, but asking someone to spy, not against their country, against their government, but for the United States. Important, and you do so, and they become a, you know, what's called a unilateral asset, and we handle them with proper tradecraft. But one of the things that I think we forget about is that our liaison relationships, our alliances in the intelligence world, they also, you know, stop weapons proliferators, help us catch terrorists, help us catch spies and remiss, provide us incredible intelligence on Russia and China. And so talk about it, your experience with liaison. And you know, again, what I think is something that is not really focused on enough, but is not only critically important, but also a skill for a case officer as well.
Well, I know we both know that depending where you serve, you spend far more time working with liaison. With is a term we can discuss, but working, managing or nurturing liaison. And I think it's important for an audience to understand, you know, sort of what it is we're talking about. Sort of liaison relationships, alliances with foreign partners, doesn't mean that they are our slaves, that they must do what we say or they're not on side. It also doesn't mean alliances are not a zero-sum game either. And too often in our political discourse, it's people are unhappy because there's a claim that we're being taken advantage of. They're not spending enough or they're not doing enough. And of course, they look at us and say the same, right? It really depends on how you define it. So there's this constant jockeying for advantage and position. The same in any family. I'm one of 10 kids. My mother's one of 15 kids. You know, when we sit down, you know, 200 of us at our, you know, at a big family gathering, we're all a family. But man, the spats and brouhahas that go on within the family, and yet we are a strong family, right? Irish, right. Catholics, but man, you know, the Donnybrooks that take place, and it's the same with liaison. So people shouldn't be thinking, you know, is country, you know, are the Germans on side or not on side? It's not a black and white question. It's a question that talks about over decades, and it talks about, you know, it talks about contributing advantage to, you know, to us overall and to them. So, I think if you want to talk about what a case officer does, bring it down to the micro level. Early in our careers, we tend not to be something called declared, which is like the local government, local service, local government knows who we are. But fairly quickly, within a tour or two, depending on where you are, I don't know about you, but my third tier, I was declared everywhere, right? I mean, the Russians, the Chinese, the friggin' Mongolians knew who I was, right? And it was like cover was gone. And then you go into the part of your career, a much longer part for most of us, where you deal with foreign liaison. And to include foreign liaison with the Russians, right? You know, right. And, which allows you access to them as well. So they're good parts of it. So liaison is something that Hollywood and in the popular imagination is not something that people talk about or think about it much. But on a day-to-day basis, when you think about what you did in your last three or four tours, you probably spent more time managing liaison relationships and explaining them to Washington on like the intricacies that they don't understand than you do actually handling sort of a unilateral asset, depending on your position, especially when you're in management.
So, I think back to, I mean, I handled a relationship with I got to be careful, of course, as you know this, and how we say it, with a royal family in the Middle East.
Sure.
And in some cases, yeah, because of the unique nature of CIA, perhaps CIA has had these relationships even, or deeper relationships even than our counterparts in the State Department would have. So you're right. So it's not only just in terms of liaison and the bilat relationship, it's actually the political relationship too. And let me just ask, there was a piece in the New York Times over the weekend, I think it was by Peter Baker, that talked about, kind of a growing sense of, and I think he called it panic in Europe about a second Trump administration. And I think, we're not going to, there's no reason to sit here and, kind of start bashing Trump for it, although I think there's that we do that a lot, but it's more of your experience as administrations changed when you were in those positions where you had to deal with the Foreign Service, and how was the Trump administration during that time? How was that different? And of course, what do you think is going to happen if there's a second term?
Oh man, I prefer not to go into hypotheticals, but let's compare, cards. I've happily and loyally served both Republican and Democratic right. administrations.
As we all did.
As we all have. And was never partisan, still not. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, right? I'm pro-US and hard to put into a box, not, progressive on some things and very conservative, right. especially on national security issues on others. But whatever conservative means. But basically, except for like embroidering on the edges, there was never a change in liaison relationships. There was an understanding that this was, especially in NATO, Article 5. And for your audience, that means that we all come to, an attack on one is an attack on everyone. And that guarantees that NATO has never been attacked, right? The last administration was the only administration since World War II to place Article 5 in doubt. That went on for a very long time where they talked about would they openly stand down in Article 5. Eventually and grudgingly, they inferred or suggested, I'm trying to think of the right word, that no, Article 5 still stands. But for the other countries on the front lines, that makes us much less of a trusted partner. And this is where things begin to fray. Now, you talked about the Pacific, where we don't have a NATO. We had CETO for a while, and it was a failure. Not all alliances work, and CETO went out in the early 70s, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. But I think, talking about the New York Times, you mentioned having Japan and South Korea together at Camp David, talking together is something I think that is more important in guaranteeing American security and our rule based order that allows us to buy, cheap jeans from Vietnam and allows oil to flow through to Taiwan so we can buy computers and all the rest of this. All of this is based, the relationship with the Japanese and the South Koreans is more important than building more battleships and is more important than building any amount of aircraft carriers that we could have. Enormous cost savings to the American taxpayer. And beyond that, I think this administration and even the administration before this at a working level were working to create a better relationship with India. So the right. Quad, which is, the Indians, the Australians, ourselves and Japan. I think that's also incredibly important, not so much to contain China, although that would sort of be a benefit for it, but to create a in the South China Sea and other places to create a sense of of confidence and trust that one can invest and trade, and being here in Hawaii, that's enormously important as well, as for vis-a-vis North Korea, vis-a-vis Russia, vis-a-vis China and others who would do us ill.
Well, you know, something came to mind as you were talking, and perhaps you had these experiences too. Again, we always have to be careful about putting time and place and country you're in. But I remember, you know, I had some interlocutors. I will say from Europe when I was still in and was the operations chief for Europe and Eurasia, who really did come to me and said, you know, have you all lost your mind? And this was when, of course, the former president was bashing NATO, and you know that I think for good reason. I do sympathize with our current colleagues now in various European capitals who will have to deal with this, and you know the notion also that there would be less adults in the room. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why you know Article 5 commitments were adhered to is because you did have people in the national security apparatus who did believe that. If the president did not, at least they did, whether it's the National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, others. I don't see any responsible adults who would join a second term.
Right. So America first doesn't mean America only, and it shouldn't. Right. And that makes right. it makes us weaker. Also, too, in talking about alliances, let's talk about countries that don't have allies.
Ah, that's right.
Weaker ones. Now, I think it speaks volumes that neither Russia nor China, they may have a few vassal states like Syria that are only good for as long as the dictator's around, right? Or Lukashenko, who's going to be, you know, will be overthrown within our lifetime, I'm betting. But they have no allies whatsoever. They have a few people like, you know, Iran and Russia. I mean, that is a transactional, you know, that is a transactional relationship between two, you know, between a theocracy and a dictatorship. And it is as strong as the Hitler-Stalin pact, right? And so they don't have real relations, they don't have real alliances. And that makes them in the long run much weaker than the US.
Well, you know, the greatest allies are ones that you certainly share. You do have some shared values, but also that can inspire each other. And so I agree, you know, Russia, China, Iran, much different case. So this is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of the podcast and all of other shows in full, please go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $5 a month, and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We will be right back in a moment. All right. Hi, we are back with Jerry O'Shea, as I noted earlier, one of the great CIA officers of my generation, someone who I certainly looked up to. Maybe you're a bit older than I am.
It's a pretty friggin' low bar, I'll tell you that.
But it's true. And we also have some great mutual friends. John Cypher, of course, one of your business partners, but also someone who's been a good friend of mine, someone who's been on the show here as well. And so I will only say that as this the title of course, the program is the DSR, the Deep State Radio Spy Show. Sometimes we always think of our old haunting ground, the Vienna Inn, as the center of the deep state. So anyone who wants to join us, it's certainly worth it. Look, we have about a couple minutes left. I want to kind of raise two issues. One, let's get to the entertainment world in just a second, but we'd be remiss in not talking about the Afghan withdrawal as we're on. I think it's the 2-year anniversary coming up now. You spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. Again, you were one of the heroes who went in after September 11th, sometimes with the notion that you were not sure of coming back. Those times were I think a lot of people forget. I will say there was a lot of fear in the country, and certainly for those who had kind of, you know, jumped on helicopters and flew in a month after the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were hit. You all, well, I think the nation owes you, you know, great credit.
I didn't get in until about 3 or 4 months afterwards, so I was like in the fourth wave or so. So yeah, not one of the first guys in.
Understood. Yet you still performed a service, which I think is extraordinary. So I guess the notion is, with the Afghan withdrawal, what were your feelings on that? I mean, everyone had some strong emotions, and perhaps, you know, one could also argue that you know, we are going to be biased on this one way or the other. But what's your feeling 2 years after?
So there's a difference between heart and head. In the heart, you know, it was, I feel deeply betrayed. It was deeply tragic. I think this was completely unnecessary. That's a head thing, completely unnecessary. I think we've made a horrific error on that, an unforced error, one that didn't need to happen. But in my head, you know, politics are real, and Americans, for whatever reason, and I think wrongly, misinformedly, wanted out after 20 years. You know, I guess it's okay to stay in Korea for 50 or 60 years, right? And, you know, in our interest, or Germany or these other places. But for some reason, Afghanistan, despite the fact that, you know, the losses over 18 months, I think we'd had zero losses in combat in the 18 months prior to that. Our role really was in providing air support and medical support and keeping their planes flying and keeping a confidence level up by being there. And I think by withdrawing, it was again a huge error. I think also that there was a huge misunderstanding, primarily by people who'd never been there, Mark. And I'd like your take on that.
Right.
If you've been there, you sort of get a better understanding of the place. I think it was simply beyond the imagination of analysts and policymakers that it could fall so fast. Those of us who've been there, especially in the early days, who watched, you know, the entire Taliban army turn into the Northern Alliance overnight when they thought it was the right side, right? And then, you know, the same thing happened going out. And, you know, for Afghan women and for American leadership, I think this was a, you know, something deeply sad and something I'm deeply disappointed in the Biden administration about.
So I really do think this is the Biden administration's Achilles heel. You know, you saw several months ago, the NSC put out a 12-page document basically blaming the Trump administration for everything, which I think was a terrible unforced error. Because, you know, my argument has been the Doha Accords was one of the great diplomatic failures in United States history, but the Biden administration didn't have to adhere to it. The Taliban were violating it. And so there's so much blame to go around. But I certainly agree with you. I think with a small force of 2,500, intelligence and special operations personnel, we could have kept things together. And, you know, one last piece on this, you know, it's kind of funny. I started off my career on the Afghan desk, of all places. I think there's about 2.5 people there in 1993. And what was happening then, of course, was the rise of the Taliban. But just like then, and then similarly, when we were there early on, I did kind of two stints there, you know, one several months after 9/11 and then a year as a base chief. You do see Afghans switch sides. I mean, that's just what they do. It's a game of survival. I remember talking to an Afghan tribal chief, and he said that, I got to get this right, his father's great grandfather was a communist under the Najibullah regime. Then he became a mujahideen fighting the Muj, and then Taliban came into power. He joined them. Then we came, switched sides, and he said, "Hey, when you all leave, I'll probably switch right back because they're survivors." And so the notion that things would fall. The last piece I'll say, and I'll quote, you know, a friend of ours, you know, Mike Morrell is the deputy director and the acting director of CIA, and he told me one day, he said he called in chiefs of station in Kabul when they come back, and not a single one ever said that the Afghans would be able to fight on their own. The notion that what the U.S. military tried to do was build kind of a not just a partner force, but a force that, you know, we could take the training wheels off and then leave. I don't think there's many CIA officers who would ever kind of sign on to that. I really do think that was not something that when we would come back and talk to our leadership or go down to the White House, anyone from the intelligence community would ever say. So, but it's, you know, I do agree that the American people wanted out, and so this is a tough one.
Foolishly, we were talking about alliances, and I think, you know, the CIA at the end of, you know, after 9/11, we created a set of alliances amongst the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, some of the Pashto, the Hazara, that allowed it to basically run for 20 years. And when, I'll just say it, when policy and our U.S. military colleagues tried to build something that wasn't Afghan, a unified force that wasn't built on the natural alliances that CIA built, it fell apart. It didn't have the cohesion, even though every year, every outgoing, you know, U.S. military commander said, oh, it's gotten better and better and better. And we knew it wasn't. The Afghans are loyal to family, to tribe, to Kel, to each other, but not to this flag, this thing called Afghanistan. And so we got the alliance thing. We got it wrong. And the last thing I'd say is, you know, why were we there to begin with? It was because of 9/11. Well, we've moved on from Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but they haven't moved on from us. And, you know, it is certainly well within the, you know, it's certainly a reasonable assumption that in the next few years, there will be another 9/11 style attack on the great Satan, us, coming again out of the lawless area of Afghanistan. And then what are we going to do, right? So I think it was, we were pound foolish and penny wise, or the other way around, whatever it was. It was a fuck up, if I can say that. You know,
you can certainly say that. And again, the theme of the show being alliances, you know, we lost our partner in the Afghan government.
We did. And trust.
And that partner did a hell of a lot for us. Let's just talk a bit about the entertainment world and about Spycraft. Kind of what you're doing now. As I thought of you all the other day, we're not gonna bash any other shows, but there is a show now that's called Lioness Special Operations or Special
Ops. Let's bash it.
I was watching it and it doesn't get a hell of a lot right. In fact, I think at one point they said that it was based on a true CIA tale. I think I called you and some other former chiefs in Kabul, and I said, look, I was there. I don't remember us ever doing something like this. And so, you know, tell us what Spycraft is going to do to kind of right these wrongs and get our story straight.
Probably very little, you know, only in certain places. So, you know, Hollywood is selling entertainment, and to the extent people want authenticity and reality, which often they don't. I mean, I love James Bond and Bourne. It's pure escapism. It's fun, but it's not real, and we know it. Where I think audiences become confused and we become irked, if that's the right word, is when Hollywood purports that what they're showing on screen is reality or, you know, a verisimilitude thereof. And yeah, there are times in some CIA officer's life where we'll actually be in a car chase or we'll have a gunfight, but that generally means you've made a mistake, a big one, right? Yeah. And you know, most of what we do, the quotidian stuff, is not exciting for on the screen. Although the themes that we deal with, betrayal, huge stakes, you know, living a secret life, all these things are the stuff that Hollywood loves. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is, to those that want more authenticity, more realism, and more character interaction, because at its core, spying is an intimate human interaction. In fact, arguably, it's the most intimate set of relationships you can have outside of romance, right? I mean, we deal with people, they bear their souls to us in ways that I can't tell my spouse or my parents or my best friends, but there's something eating at my soul and I need someone to talk to. I can't operate inside of my government anymore, which is like destroying our own people. I remember one guy, his country was becoming involved in a war, and he said, you know, my wife belongs to the ethnic group that is, you know, that is this warmongering dictator who runs it. I'm not. I don't want my son to kill my own people, right? He was from a minority group. And he's like, I can't tell my wife, although I love her. I can't tell my friends, but someone has to do something, right? And so he didn't want money. He wanted basically a peaceful conscience, and he wanted to know that he'd done something to protect his family. And, you know, those sort of portrayals in Hollywood, I think, are lacking. Those deeply conflicted, difficult interpersonal relationships that we know so well.
Right. I mean, so when I think about what I miss, you know, I certainly miss the camaraderie of working, you know, with yourself and others, sometimes being on the tip of the spear, knowing you're doing something great for America. But the essence of the job was that relationship you had with your asset, which I think you're right. There's nothing like, you know, you can sort of compare it to a romance, but it's so deeply personal. And you know, I remember, you know, assets, particularly in situations with a high counterintelligence environment, saying to me that, you know, you have my life in your hands.
Right.
You know, and if you're at 25, 30, 35, whatever years old, there's not many jobs on the planet where literally if you screw up, someone is, you know, may die. And, right. And also, of course, having to deal with all of their, mental struggle is the wrong word, but just emotions on betraying sure. their government and sometimes not even telling their family. I mean, it's pretty right. extraordinary.
Right. And people forget, you know, the levels of skin in the game. And what brought it home for me was this one time in a third world country, I have a brand new asset in the car and we're driving. He's just been recruited. We're still working out the cover story and everything is going through. And we drove into, he's in my vehicle. It's late at night. And we drove into a checkpoint by the right. local security forces, who weren't there when I drove in, right? I knew they weren't looking for us, but they're looking for something suspicious. They're looking to shake people down. And as we drove into this, you know, I said to the guy, you know, run with me. We had a basic cover story. And we drove into this checkpoint. There's guys with weapons and it's nighttime and they were still wearing sunglasses. And, you know, I handed him a pack of cigarettes, although I don't smoke. You always got cigarettes in the car. Hey, here you go. Who's the guy sitting next to you? I said, I'm interviewing him to perhaps be my gardener, right? And we just had dinner at this Chinese little takeout place, and you know, I'm taking him home now. And that was about as deep as the cover story went, but it's all we had at the time. And they said, okay, you can go. And we drove through. And as we drove through, he had a hat in his lap and he pulled the hat aside and he had a Makarov there. And he looks at me and says, they wouldn't have taken us alive. And I'm thinking, us? Dude, I got the Vienna Convention. I got diplomatic immunity. What happens right. to me is they beat the shit out of me and they send me home tomorrow. You, they execute. And I thought, yeah, we have different, you know, we're coming at our agents are the true heroes. Right. They're the ones who were taking, you know, real, much greater risks than we are. And that's something that Hollywood, I don't think, touches on.
You nailed it right there. Yeah. When you say the agents are the true heroes, you know, I mean, a lot of people, of course, you know, do have some kind of romantic notions of what life as an intelligence officer is about. But I've said this so many times too. It's those who are working for us. Those agents, those are the true heroes. And I hope you get it right. The other thing I'll just throw out there, I think, both of us at times carried weapons overseas. I am not the toughest guy in the world. I think my greatest skill was I could type really fast. And that's what I always joke about. You know, what do you need to do to become a good case officer? There's a lot more to it, but it ain't shooting. It's probably typing.
Yeah, I had the grenade of shame when I was upcountry up in the northern Afghanistan working with special forces. We were zeroing our weapons out and they watched me shoot. And one of them came over and said, I was Sean in those days. And they said, hey, Sean, he said, we're watching you shoot, man. He says, we've been talking, if you know, we ever get in the shit, and he hands me this little M90 grenade. He says, we ever get in the shit, he says, you throw that, because you know, you've got big shoulders. He says, don't try to shoot your way out of it. And I thought, yeah, man, it's Jack. Like, I am not a gun guy, right?
Got it.
Yeah.
Jerry, this has been awesome. Unfortunately, it's all the time we have today. I want to thank you sincerely for coming on. It was a fantastic chat. I hope you will consider coming on again soon. We can have our good mutual friend, John Cipher, join us, where he can certainly tell stories and make fun about both of us, probably. But I'd like to thank everyone else out there for listening. DSR will be back later this week with more of our regularly scheduled pods, and we hope you'll join us for them. And then join me again. And David Rothkopf will be back next week for the DSR Spy Show. Once again, Jerry, thanks. Great chat. And again, our thoughts and prayers going out to the people of Hawaii.
Thank you very much, Mark. All the best to you.